Eliminationist institutions. Perpetrators have operated in a variety of institutions, some old, such as the military and police, and some new, such as death marches, specialized mobile killing units, and camps. Leaders bent on destroying groups of people have naturally used existing organizations that could easily be deployed. The military is the most obvious one. Even a cursory global tour provides abundant examples. Starting with the Germans' annihilation of the Herero and Nama, militaries have participated in mass slaughters and eliminations throughout our age, as the lead killing institution or in a critical support role. In Asia, the Japanese military, immediately before and during World War II, was the principal agent of human destruction in China and in other countries. Elsewhere in Asia, soldiers have been at the center of the violence, including the Indonesian slaughter of the communists and later their eliminationist occupation of East Timor, and the Pakistanis' assault on Bangladesh. In Uganda, in Burundi, and elsewhere in Africa, where the military has often been one of the few coherent institutions of the continent's poor countries, it has been the main instrument of mass slaughter and elimination. In Latin America, including in Guatemala in the 1960s through the 1990s, principally soldiers annihilated the various regimes' targets. In the Middle East, the Syrian army leveled much of Hama and slaughtered its residents, and the Iraqi army killed first northern Iraq's Kurds and then southern Iraq's Shia marsh people and lay waste to their habitat. It may be that in our age, armies have killed or helped kill more people in human extermination campaigns than in military ones. Paramilitary and police forces have also frequently slaughtered people in eliminationist campaigns. Such forces carried out much of the Serbs' killing and expulsion of Muslims and Croats, and the Croats' killing and expulsion of Serbs. Many of the Serbian murderers in Bosnia were paramilitaries, most notoriously Arkan's Tigers, the butchers Arkan, whose real name was Jelko Raznatovic, organized and led, who spearheaded killings and expulsions in Bosnia and earlier in Croatia. While Arkan's Tigers came mainly from Serbia proper, such paramilitaries in Bosnia appear to have been mostly Bosnian Serbs. In Rwanda, where virtually every manner of person and organization took part in slaughtering Tutsi, the Interahamwe paramilitary force was at the slaughter's forefront. Often, the pre-existing institutions of violence work in concert. Militaries have frequently acted in a collaborative, auxiliary, or support role in eliminationist programs. The German army, its leaders and soldiers, though not the lead exterminatory institution, was still a partner in the Jews' slaughter in large areas of Europe, most notably in the territories captured from the Soviet Union. It also murdered many Russians, Ukrainians, and others, most notably Soviet POWs, around 3 million of whom the German military's leadership purposely starved to death or shot, while delivering Soviet political commissars and Jews to the SS and other German police units to be killed as part of a formal extermination campaign. In Kosovo, the Serbian army provided the infrastructure for the eliminationist project, including the killing, and carried out much of it itself, though it left considerable dirty work to paramilitary and police forces. In many African countries, armies have collaborated with paramilitaries, police, and local gangs to slaughter targeted groups, including the Hutu in Burundi, the Tutsi in Rwanda, and Idi Amin's real and imagined enemies in Uganda, as well as in Congo and Sudan today. Those leading mass eliminations, similar to many substantial national projects, often see the need for new specialized institutions. Unlike for other domestic or even international campaigns of violence, eliminationist leaders frequently create distinctive new destructive social systems, death marches, mobile killing units, and camp worlds. Death marches are part of an eliminationist onslaught that has mass killing as a major component. The perpetrators force the victims to march for weeks or months to some distant destination, never to return. They starve their victims, expose them to the elements, privation, and suffering that cause many to die, in addition to those whom the perpetrators kill directly with guns or blows. Death marches vary in the percentage of their victims who end up lying dead along the way. Sometimes the perpetrator's explicit purpose is to kill all or most of the marchers, having chosen marches as a surrogate for guns or swords. Sometimes the perpetrators let many marchers die from starvation, exposure, illnesses, or wounds, even though mass slaughter is not intended as their principal eliminationist means. Yet, whatever the perpetrator's varying intent, and whatever the highly varying percentage of people who actually die on such marches, all these marches should be understood to be death marches because the perpetrators conduct all of them in a manner that guarantees many deaths. And from the perpetrator's standpoint, and often in actual fact, the marches are a surrogate for killing their victims, with the survivors rendered socially and politically dead. Death marches present a pitiable sight. The perpetrators force hundreds and thousands of emaciated, destitute, exhausted, bedraggled people to trudge through the countryside. These images of people subjecting others, including children, to such cruelty defies ordinary social experience. Death marches convey to onlookers that the victims are beyond sociability's realm, vulnerable and fair game to be attacked or robbed of their meager possessions, tortured or killed. Death marches have frequently provided a ready opportunity for onlookers to transform themselves voluntarily into perpetrators, as at different moments Turks, Germans, Serbs, Sudanese, and others did. Death marches span our age. The Germans in Southwest Africa initiated the 20th century's mass murdering with the death march of the Herero into the Kalahari Desert, where the vast majority, as planned, perished. The century ended with the Serbs forcing the Kosovars on a death march to Albania, where almost all arrived and stayed until NATO compelled the Serbs to let them return. The 21st century has opened with ethnically Islamic Sudanese driving Darfurians into neighboring Chad. Throughout our age, regimes have created death marches as principal or auxiliary eliminationist institutions. The Turks sent hundreds of thousands of Armenians, mainly women and children, on marches of hundreds of miles lasting weeks, encouraging local people along the way to attack, brutalize, and slaughter them. In 1918, the American consul Jesse Jackson in Aleppo reported that survivors had recounted the harrowing details of the separation of the grown male members of their families therefrom, or the actual killing of them before the eyes of their relatives and friends, or of the robbing of the immigrants en route, of the unlimited suffering and death of famished women and children, the unbelievable brutality of the accompanying gendarmes toward young girls and more attractive women, the carrying off by the Kurds and Turks of beautiful girls, women, and children, and countless other atrocious crimes committed against them all along the way. An extremely high, though unknown, percentage of the Armenians never reached Aleppo, their ostensible destination. In 1915, an American observing the deportations estimated that 3/4 of the deportees would die. In October 1916, Jackson described the Turks' treatment of one death march caravan. For another 5 days, the Armenians did not receive a morsel of bread, neither a drop of water. They were scorched to death by thirst. Hundreds upon hundreds fell dead along the way, their tongues turned to charcoal. On the 75th day, when they reached Halep, Aleppo, 150 women and children remained from the whole caravan of 18,000. In 1918, as the eliminationist assault was winding down, another American consul in Turkey, Leslie Davis, reflected on the eliminationist assault of the past few years. "I predicted few of these people would ever reach Urfa, which was all too true a prediction." yet even those who survived were not spared. According to one Turkish military intelligence officer, the Turks drove them to the blazing desert, to hunger, misery, and death. The first march that had Death March affixed to it as part of its proper name is the Bataan Death March of 1942, the murderous trek on which the Japanese sent American and Filipino POWs in the Philippines. The Japanese marched them in stifling tropical heat for a week, denying them food and aid, brutalizing them, and butchering stragglers and others, often in gruesome ways. The Japanese killed 18,000 of the 72,000 on the march, a one-week mortality rate of 25%. In World War II's last 6 months, as the Germans emptied camps that would soon be overrun, they sent the Jews on scores of death marches, making them a familiar sight in much of Germany and Central Europe. The Jews' death rate on many marches approximated that of extermination facilities. After the war, Poles, Czechs, and others expelled millions of ethnic Germans. They sent these Germans on such marches, the local populace often treating them brutally. Although the Germans often traveled on trains or other vehicles in what were, for expulsions, comparatively tolerable conditions. The most concentrated, gargantuan death marches were created by the Khmer Rouge, which emptied Cambodia's cities of virtually their entire populations. From Phnom Penh alone, they drove between 2 million and 3 million of the country's fewer than 8 million people into the countryside, brutally propelling them onward, sometimes for weeks, until they reached the designated places for their camps, called cooperatives. Yokimni Chan recounts his death march. The Khmer Rouge, upon capturing Phnom Penh on April 17, 1975, announced that everyone had to leave the city, dispossessing the city's inhabitants, including, as was true of Chan's family, their cars. "Now everyone in our family had to walk, and we had to divide the remaining food among us to carry it on our backs. It was the dry season, and it was very hot. There was no water. People began to get heat stroke and fall down on the road. The soldiers wouldn't let us stop to help those who were sick. I couldn't believe what was happening. We walked for days, then weeks. Pregnant women gave birth under trees by the road. Old people died from exhaustion and lack of water. Everywhere was the sound of babies screaming and people crying for loved ones who had died and had to be left on the road. There was no time for funerals. Soldiers threw the bodies into empty ponds and kept everyone moving. Guns were pointed at us, and tanks forced us to keep moving. I saw two men with their hands tied behind their backs. Soldiers were questioning them on the side of the road. The soldiers cut off the men's heads, which fell to the ground as their bodies slumped. There was nothing I could do. People were being murdered before my eyes. These were my friends, my neighbors. The rest of us kept walking. Finally, after almost 2.5 months of walking and stopping, walking and stopping, we arrived outside the province of Battambang, where most of the small villages in the jungle had been burned to ashes during the fighting. We were told that we must live in those burned-out villages. On these marches, the Khmer Rouge intentionally killed and drove to death many tens of thousands, perhaps as many as 400,000 people. They forced the survivors to locales that could not sustain them, lacking housing, infrastructure, viable economies, and often even arable land. Thus began the Khmer Rouge's eliminationist transformation of Cambodia. A partly parallel instance occurred in Ethiopia when the Derg dictatorship under Mengistu Haile Mariam, starting in fall 1984, sent approximately 1.5 million people from northern Ethiopia on death marches to the southwest as part of a resettlement program intended to pacify Ethiopia's northern region, where rebel groups were fighting the government. The Ethiopian perpetrators killed about 100,000 people during the death marches or in their aftermath as survivors perished in the resettlement camps. Among the most chaotic death marches were the many that moved more than 14 million people between India and Pakistan during the region's partition in 1947 when the British pulled out. Although this population transfer was intended to allow Muslims in India and Hindi living in Pakistan to resettle in the other country, they became death marches that took the lives of roughly a half million people. Their transformation into mutual eliminationist assaults came about in part because the local populace in many regions and on both sides understood them as death marches, and because those same local people were encouraged by their leaders with their killing squads to turn their conceptions of what the marches were or should be into reality. Unlike camps, which are fixed-in-space multi-purpose installations, death marches are transitory, single-purpose institutions. Although they sometimes are revived or reconstituted, they generally come into being for a defined time and expire when their victims are gone. Most death marches are either mainly annihilatory, as the Germans' marches of the Herero and, 40 years later, of Jews were, or mainly expulsive, as the Serbs' March of Kosovars, the Derg's March of Northern Ethiopians, and the Sudanese political Islamists driving from their homes of Darfurians have been. Whichever, all such marches are variations upon a lethal eliminationist theme. Since expulsion marches of civilians are by definition eliminationist, they inherently tend toward lethal violence. Perpetrators who compel people to abandon their homes or banish them abroad convey the message that these people are dangerous or noxious enough to deserve elimination. In the modern world, social and physical attachment to a physical place is seen as a constituent part of community membership. Being wrested from one's place suggests an abrogation of a person's full humanity. Ordinarily, societies treat only criminals in such a way. Those violently driving people from their homes, particularly families that have resided there for generations, relegate their victims to the status of outlaws, literally outside the law, to whom virtually anything may be done. The Soviets treated the Crimean Tatars, one of the 8 ethnic groups they deported for putative disloyalty, with murderous brutality. At 2 o'clock in the morning of May 17, 1944, Tatar homes were suddenly broken into by NKVD agents and NKVD troops armed with automatics. They dragged sleeping women, children, and old people from their beds and, shoving automatics into their ribs, ordered them to be out of their homes within 10 minutes. Without giving them a chance to collect themselves, they forced these residents out into the street, where trucks picked them up and drove them to railroad stations. They were loaded into cattle cars and shipped off to remote regions of Siberia, the Urals, and Central Asia. People were not allowed to get dressed properly. They were forbidden to take clothes, money, or other things with them. The agents and armed troops swept through these homes, taking these people's valuables, money, and anything they liked, all the while calling the Tatars swine, scum, damned traitors, and so on. These people left their homes naked and hungry and traveled that way for a month. In the locked, stifling freight cars, people began to die from hunger and illness. The NKVD troops would seize the corpses and throw them out of the freight car windows. Death marches and expulsions express eliminationist beliefs' multiple potential. For the perpetrators, expelling and killing go hand in hand and are interchangeable. This is so for leaders creating the marches, those guarding them, and the local people jeering, brutalizing, and sometimes murdering the marchers whose banishment they celebrate. The same spirit infuses death marches and expulsions' aftermath. The perpetrators deposit the survivors en masse in distant places without physical or economic infrastructure, and so, predictably, many more die. The perpetrators know, witness, and promote this, or at least allow it to happen, with perhaps the most infamous instance being the Khmer Rouge. The Germans' deportation plans for Jews are documented cases of eliminationist intent and of the interchangeability of eliminationist solutions. The two most comprehensive proposals receiving serious consideration were, first, to create a reservation for the Jews in eastern Poland's Lublin region, and, second, to ship millions of Jews to Madagascar. The Germans' proposals for mass expulsion, including these two, were interim steps on the road to the Jews' extinction. Those fashioning these schemes conceived of the proposed dumping grounds as uninhabitable environments. As the district governor of Lublin suggested in November 1939, the district, with its very marshy character, could serve as a Jew reservation, a measure which could possibly lead to a widespread decimation of the Jews. The proposed reservations were to be enormous prisons, like walled-in ghettos that the Germans constructed for Polish Jewry, consisting of economically unsustainable territory where the Jews, cut off from the world, would die off. In Ethiopia, the Derg expelled 1.5 million northerners, exposing them to new diseases, including malaria, which led to hundreds of thousands of deaths, especially the sick, the elderly, and children. One former Derg member who witnessed the Tigrayans' brutal, murderous deportation, packed into buses like Jews in cattle cars, called the resettlement a genocide of helpless people. An often used eliminationist killing institution is the mobile killing squad. Its function, unlike the death marches, is unambiguously recognized. It is neither some informal, marauding, murderous group, nor an established institution of a normal polity, such as the military that might kill episodically, along with other non-eliminationist duties. The mobile killing institution is both formal and enduring, principally devoted to annihilation and elimination. To spearhead and execute the Armenians' elimination, the Turkish leaders created a substantially autonomous institution, the Special Organization, which, having its own funding and organizational structure, functioned as a virtual state within the state. Consisting of approximately 30,000 men, mainly criminals, the Special Organization's principal task was to exterminate the Armenians. Its units went from town to town rounding up victims, shooting men, and sending the remainder on death marches, which the Special Organization's men would sometimes themselves murderously fall upon. Among the new institutions the Ethiopian Derg created to conduct its operations were Revolutionary Death Squads and the Derg Special Forces, which early in the regime's tyranny killed 15 to 30 youths in each of Addis Ababa's 28 zones in order to terrorize its actual and potential opposition. In many Latin American countries, including Argentina, Brazil, Chile, Colombia, El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, murderous regimes created shadowy death squads that struck anywhere, descending upon targeted individuals and groups, killing or abducting them, usually to kill them later, and then melting away. In Guatemala, the regime and army created a special mobile killing institution that was formally conceived of as a counterinsurgency force called Caibiles. In Guatemala, the regime and army created a special mobile killing institution that was formally conceived of as a counterinsurgency force called Caibiles. Among the most lethal and notorious mass murderers are the German Einsatzgruppen, which the German leadership established for the attack against the Soviet Union in June 1941. The Einsatzgruppen, in conjunction with supporting police and military units, and sometimes also with local Ukrainian, Lithuanian, and other auxiliaries, began, as planned, in the campaign's first few days to slaughter Jews. As the Germans went deeper into Soviet territory, their killing pace and scope increased. Typically, they rounded up the Jews of a conquered town or city in the city square or at its outskirts, brought the victims to anti-tank ditches or ravines, or to a location where they forced the Jews to dig large ditches, and shot them at point-blank range in wave after wave after wave. Sometimes they stood the victims at the ditch's edge to be shot in turn. Sometimes they compelled the victims to lay themselves down in the ditch upon the bleeding, dead bodies of the group just killed, and then shot them. Depending on the Jewish community's size and the Germans' operation logistics, the number of victims ranged from a few dozen to 10,000 or more. The Einsatzgruppen's most infamous killing operation was on Kiev's outskirts, at Babi Yar's ravines, where over 2 days they, together with other German units and Ukrainian auxiliaries, shot more than 33,000 Jews. During the assault on Soviet Jewry's first wave, from June 1941 to the first part of 1942, the Germans in the Einsatzgruppen slaughtered probably more than 500,000 Jews, mainly by shooting them. For their mass murdering and expulsions in Bosnia, the Serbs employed their own mobile killing units, which often went by colorful names: the Yellow Wasps, the White Eagles, the Wolves from Vujak, and most notoriously, Arkan's Tigers. Because the Serbs had opted for a mixed eliminationist solution, kill many people, expel more, these squads were not as pure a killing institution as the Germans' Einsatzgruppen were toward Jews. The Serbs' units slaughtered Bosniaks as they expunged town after town of non-Serbs. Their brutality and cruelty became legendary in Bosnia and throughout the region. Arkan's Tigers became the institution that epitomized and became almost synonymous with the eliminationist assault itself. Infamous though they have become, the creation of such distinctive formal mobile killing institutions has not been common because most eliminationist regimes that need mobile units use the military and police. Often they rely on local police and other forces to do the dirty work against their neighbors. They sometimes raise these units, as the Germans and Guatemalans did, because they decide that specialized killing units will serve them especially well. At other times, as in Bosnia and several Latin American countries, such units operate in the shadows, providing political leaders deniability. In Latin American countries, they have been appropriately called death squads. Still more permanent and more lethal than mobile killing institutions have been camp systems, some of which are called concentration camps. More often, the perpetrators and those wittingly or unwittingly adopting their perspectives and nomenclature call them various euphemistic names, including resettlement camps, labor camps, re-education camps, agricultural camps, and cooperatives. Many regimes and people have used camps as eliminationist tools, including the Spanish, British, Germans, French, Soviets, Americans, Poles, Chinese, North Koreans, Indonesians, Cambodians, Serbs, Hutu, and more. Camps are socio-political systems for sequestering people, usually for broader domination, transformation, and destruction. Political leaders bent on eliminating a sizable number of people create them when existing institutions appear inadequate for their destructive or transformative goals. Eventually, an integrated system of dozens, hundreds, or even thousands of camps can become an enduring, useful, and seemingly indispensable instrument in eliminationist destruction, which the regimes put to several interrelated uses. Camps eliminate unwanted people from society's concourse, depositing them in a spatial, social, and moral netherworld. Permanent elimination may follow. Camps can be used for temporary elimination during military conflicts, as the British did in South Africa to Boers during the Second Boer War of 1899 to 1902, and then half a century later, at least initially, to Kikuyu during the Mau Mau Rebellion in Kenya, and as the Americans did to more than 100,000 Japanese Americans during World War II. In such instances, the incarcerators released the inmates when the war or declared emergency ended. Camps can also be used in a more temporary manner as short-lived extermination facilities or as intermittently lethal holding tanks awaiting the moment when the elimination process of those surviving the camp's initial killings moves to expulsion. In Rwanda, the Hutu set up ad hoc extermination camps in churches, hospitals, and other local institutions to which Tutsi had fled for sanctuary. The Hutu compelled the Tutsi to stay in these places, now camps. Daily, the Hutu brutalized and killed the Tutsi in the camp or removed them to kill them nearby. In Bosnia, the Serbs used camps as extermination facilities, mainly for Muslim men, and as way stations for Bosniak children and women, whom they often raped or otherwise brutalized, before expelling them, including on death marches. Regimes also use camps for the semi-permanent or permanent elimination of people. They can be a brutal, often lethal, temporary part of a larger eliminationist campaign until the survivor's expulsion ensues. The Turks established such camps for Armenians. The Poles created such camps for ethnic Germans after Poland's liberation from German occupation, often using former German camps, including Auschwitz, Lambsdorff, and Jaworzno, to confine approximately 100,000 Germans suspected of being Nazis, and then, having killed between 20% and 50% of them, dismantling the camps when they expelled the remaining inmates to Germany. In Kenya, the British camp system, which included the barbed wire villages of the Kikuyu reservations, evolved into what was going to be a semi-permanent or permanent arrangement to eliminate the non-compliant Kikuyu. The Indonesians, upon slaughtering communists, created a temporary camp system incarcerating between 650,000 and 1.5 million people for shorter or longer periods. Our era's more permanent camp systems include, among others, the German camp world, the Soviet Gulag, the Chinese Lao Gai, Cambodia's cooperatives, and North Korea's Kwanliso. Camps, especially when they are permanent installations, are used to put people to work. The Germans during the Nazi period, the Soviets, the Chinese, the Khmer Rouge, and the North Koreans did this. But camps and the work within are not governed according to rational productivity's norms or even the standard of the minimal humanness accorded to society's non-camp population. Take the camp system that was probably the most productive among all the major camp systems, the Soviet Gulag. In the fall, they kept people, in Kolyma, located above the Arctic Circle, soaked to the skin out in the rain and the cold to fulfill norms, production quotas, that such hopeless wrecks could never fulfill. Prisoners were not dressed for the climate in the Kolyma region. They were given third-hand clothing, mere rags, and often had only cloth wrapping on their feet. Their torn jackets did not protect them from the bitter frost, and people froze in droves. No wonder these inmates froze. They worked outdoors regularly in temperatures as low as 60 degrees below zero. Murderous regimes and the executors of their policies work inmates under the most egregious conditions, denying them sufficient food, adequate clothing, shelter, sanitation, and medical care. Eleanor Kipper, a former communist prisoner in Kolyma, explains, "Even if the work performed is listed honestly, it is impossible for a person unaccustomed to physical labor to fulfill the quota. He quickly falls into a vicious circle. Since he cannot do his full quota of work, he does not receive the full bread ration. His undernourished body is still less able to meet the demands, and so he gets less and less bread, and in the end is so weakened that only clubbing can force him to drag himself from camp to gold mine. Once he reaches the shaft, he is too weak to hold the wheelbarrow, let alone to run the drill. He is too weak to defend himself when a criminal punches him in the face and takes away his day's ration of bread." In the massive camp systems incarcerating millions, the prisoner's overall output can seem substantial. Yet in these socially and economically artificial environments, productivity, the real measure of economic output, is incredibly low because of the dreadful circumstances and physical condition in which the perpetrators force their victims to work, and because of the poor available plant, machinery, and tools. Camp systems' economic productivity is actually lower still, because in wresting irreplaceable people and resources from the normal economy, they disrupt it substantially. In Cambodia, such economic destruction was almost total. The camp systems that eventually return their victims to society leave lasting physical, mental, and emotional scars and social disabilities. Like freed slaves who bear an ongoing social stigma, former camp inmates are people whom others wish to keep at arm's length. Unless formally rehabilitated, as some were in the Soviet Union who then even rose to high positions, they are marked as having been in the camp netherworld. As long as the eliminationist regime is in power, they are suspect. Getting close to such a person is potentially to court danger. Even those former inmates who are not seen in this way find that others, even sometimes in countries to which they subsequently emigrate, often define their lives by their time in the camps, mostly with pity. Two other purposes of camps, whatever they are formally called, are well known: to kill and to terrorize a political regime's enemies, potential opposition, or future targets. The Germans' extermination camps, Auschwitz, Treblinka, and others, are the most notorious killing facilities. For Jews, and Sinti and Roma, though not for other prisoners, the Germans' camps in general, not just these death factories constructed for mass annihilation, were extermination facilities, with mortality rates often approaching 100%. Their large Mauthausen camps' comparative death rates demonstrate the disparity. At Mauthausen, 100% of Jews were killed during November to December 1942, January to February 1943, and November to December 1943. At the same time, less than 5% of the camp's political prisoners, criminals, asocials, Poles, and Soviet civilian workers were killed. Similarly, the Germans killed, mainly by starvation, a vast number of Soviet soldiers in POW camps. Soviet, Communist Chinese, Khmer Rouge, and North Korean camps were or are also institutions of colossal mass killing. Although Kolyma in Arctic Siberia, like other camps in the communist world, was formally a work camp, the Soviets worked its prisoners to death by the hundreds of thousands. The Soviet Gulag and the Chinese camps housed and killed enormous populations. Under the most brutal communist regimes, the societies as a whole, or at least many of their institutions, are themselves organized like large, often murderous camps, or verge on being such institutions. Demarcating the formal camp system from a regime's other institutions of domination that house people can be difficult. Yet if we restrict this discussion to forced labor camps, the numbers are staggering enough. The Communist Chinese built at least one forced labor camp in each of more than 2,000 counties during the 1950s. During the regime's first few years, from 1949 to 1953, they eliminated 10 million to 15 million people by confining them in these lethal institutions. In central and southern China, they supplied their victims with about 18 ounces, 500 grams of food a day. Estimates of the labor camp death toll during this period are, as with practically all of the Chinese's mass murdering, wildly divergent, yet a conservative estimate is more than 2 million. Soviets aside, the regimes, leaders, and guards who run large camp systems do not hide them from their societies. Such enormous systems as those of the Germans, Soviets, Chinese, Vietnamese, Khmer Rouge, North Koreans, or even American internment camps for Japanese Americans and the British pipeline in Kenya would be impossible to conceal. But while some seek to prevent them from being known, such as the Soviets, who sequestered them in Siberia and the uninhabited Arctic, others publicized them, as the British colonials in Kenya did. The Germans constructed more than 10,000 camps around Europe and thousands in Germany itself. Berlin alone had 645 camps just for forced laborers, and the Hesse, about the size of New Jersey, had at least 606 camps, one for every 5x7 mile patch. Germans knew full well about the camps and their basic functions of violent domination, enslavement, and killing. The farcical notion that ordinary Germans did not know about these things taking place openly all over their country is one of the myths that Germany's apologists still propagate, despite the unanimity of serious scholarship that knowledge even of the Jews' mass murder was enormously widespread in Germany. The broader populace's knowledge of the camp's character and murderousness varies from country to country. Yet that camps exist as eliminationist institutions of great privation and violent domination is well known. Secrecy is unfeasible and is usually not even desired. Morally, the eliminationist regimes consider the camps just, and, instrumentally, they often use the camps to terrorize even people outside them whom they wish to subjugate or eliminate. Everyone knows that entering a camp is to enter a circle of hell or beyond. Political leaders typically boast about their camps. Less than 2 months after the Nazis took power in 1933, Heinrich Himmler, the leader of Germany's SS, convened a press conference to announce the founding of the first formal camp, Dachau, and to tell Germans and the world that it would incarcerate 5,000 people. The Chinese communist leadership was proud of its Laogai camps, where leaders claimed to be re-educating people and getting them to do honest labor. The Khmer Rouge heralded its cooperatives, holding a good portion of Cambodia's population as the authentic Khmer revolutionary community. The American government saw no reason to conceal its internment of Japanese Americans. Notwithstanding its great injustice, it fundamentally differed from these others. The Indonesians were open with their country that they were incarcerating the communists they did not kill. The same was true of the British in Kenya. Regimes often announce to their followers that camps salt away putatively dangerous elements, transform them into productive and responsible people, and by implication, forge the future. Political leaders often happily convey that the camps are for eliminating unwanted groups, even if they fail to specify all the means they use. The principal, often the only reason regimes try to hide aspects of the camp system or do not publicize their existence more, is the difficulties such information might cause them abroad. The Germans, the Soviets, the Chinese, the North Koreans, to whatever extent they each have been circumspect about their camp's existence and real character because their adversaries abroad would use the truth to mobilize peoples and countries against them. The camp system has been one of our age's distinctive and quintessential eliminationist tools, frequently used for various goals serving one or another of modernity's visionary transformative projects. The major camp systems were produced by communist and Nazi regimes that called for radical societal transformation and, if not explicitly, then implicitly, the elimination of those they saw standing defiantly astride the path to the future. Such transformative regimes' political leaders, whether with foresight or through trial and error, came to understand that realizing their vision, murderous at its core, requires a social infrastructure of domination. They needed places for plunging into misery the designated implacable class enemies or the putative subhumans they did not kill, and for rendering them slaves in accord with the perpetrators' conceptions of the world. They had to fell or transform enormous numbers of people, in the case of the Germans, Soviets, and Chinese, tens of millions or hundreds of millions, and thus created an enduring system to dispatch obstructionist people and others they, for whatever ideological or capricious reason, slated for elimination. Hence the camp system, which formed a new system of each society. Under these and other regimes, camp systems became worlds of their own, maintaining relations with normal society, but governed by norms and practices that made them separate netherworlds of misery and destruction. The ways that camp systems in Germany, the Soviet Union, China, Kenya, and elsewhere were integrated into the economy and society, locally, regionally, and nationally, and the kinds of relations they had with the broader societies and their peoples are barely explored topics. Camp systems vary enormously depending on the regime's character, its transformative and eliminationist goals, the prisoners' identities, and the perpetrator's conception of the victims. Death rates vary from system to system, and even within a given system. Economically irrational, some camps nevertheless are more productively organized than others. Camp systems have differing release rates. Perpetrators' cruelty differs from system to system and within a given system, depending on who the prisoners are. The guards in the German camps personally tortured and brutalized their prisoners, especially the Jewish prisoners, much more than the Soviet guards did their prisoners. Camps' proximity to and integration into the broader society also vary enormously. The people they are meant to terrorize differ markedly. The Soviet and Chinese leaders used camp systems to terrorize almost all people, while the German leaders directed the terror potential not at the German population in general, but only at selected groups within Germany: Jews, Sinti, Roma, gays, so-called antisocial elements, dedicated political opponents, as well as vast populaces of putative subhumans in German-occupied Europe. The camp system's variable character suggests aspects of the future that each regime was building. Annihilationist and eliminationist institutions vary, then, along two dimensions, space and time. The most ad hoc one is the death march, which is created as needed and disbanded when its victims have died or reached their site of expulsion. Spatially and temporally, the death march is transitory. Those guarding the murderous marches often do so by sheer circumstance and on a one-time basis. Death marches fleetingly pass through an environment, leaving behind, except for the corpses, no visible sign. At the same time, death marches create the broadest permanent imprint on a human landscape precisely because they cover so much territory, with the dying, broken, and unwanted strewn in columns over main roads, past cities and towns, announcing to the countless bystanders unmistakably what their leaders and countrymen do in their name, and leaving indelible images in mind after mind. Mobile killing units are spatially transitory, yet endure over time. They are used repeatedly, moving from place to place, from targets to targets. They appear to be the most conventional killing institutions because they resemble military and police units, and sometimes are composed of them. In form, they are the most familiar major eliminationist institutions, though their activities defy conventional social and political life. Mobile killing units combine permanence with flexibility, allowing them to kill singly or in conjunction with other institutions, and then move on to the next kill. Their activities, or at least their effects, are also not hidden from sight, and burrow deeply into a society's consciousness. Their permanence in people's minds derives from their capacity to appear at any time, and their fleetingness comes from the likelihood that they will appear in a locale but once, even if stories of their activities can be heard repeatedly. The camp world, fixed in space and durable over time, has a destructive and lethal monumentality that escapes other eliminationist institutions, and that can become a defining feature of a regime, a society, and its human and physical landscape. As a domination and destruction system, the camp world absorbs, redirects, and reshuffles society's human and material resources. It is a social and political black hole, sucking in life and extending its gravitational field, providing a constant tug on the rest of society's consciousness and practices.